Good evening, welcome. Erev Shavuos, we're going to talk a little bit about Kabbalah Satar, about Maimon Har Sinai, about Torah in general. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech Haolam Shehakol Nehiyeh B'dvaro. So there's a fabulous Rabbeinu Bechayi that ever since I saw it, I've been searching to find it, and I can't find it since I've seen it last, which was a number of years ago. And Rabbeinu Bechayi, somewhere or other, writes that Torah has two aspects. Two things happened at Maimon Har Sinai on Shavuos. One thing was that we got a book called the Torah. That's a body of knowledge. There's a second, very distinct and very different and very significant component, that there was this Maimon Har Sinai. There was this incredible audio-visual display of seeing who and what HaKadosh Baruch Hu is. Says Rabbeinu Bechayi, listen to this because it's incredible, that these are two different nachalos. There's two different aspects of Torah. There is the content of Torah, the knowledge of Torah, and then there's the regesh of Torah. The knowledge was the yediyos that he gave us, and the regesh was the Maimon Har Sinai aspect, and these each are the nachalos of a different population. The content and the knowledge of Torah was that which was given to the men, and the regesh, the Maimon Har Sinai aspect, was that which was given to the women. And ends off Rabbeinu Bechayi after he makes this very subtle distinction. He says, who knows if which one is more important? It is not clear which one is more important. In fact, he's noted to assume that the latter one is more important because it's the emotions and the connection of emuna and bitachon and connection to HaKadosh Baruch Hu that we got through the Maimon Har Sinai, even if we wouldn't have gotten the Torah. Like we say in the Haggadah, Yilu kevanu fnei ha'sinai v'lo nasan lanu es ha'torah dayenu, olam ha'farshim es dayenu, if we didn't get the Torah, what's the point of Maimon Har Sinai? And this, Rabbeinu Bechayi answers that question, that Maimon Har Sinai was the time that we got the connection, that emuna, that deep feeling towards HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that, if a person learns Torah without the feeling of connection to Hashem, the whole learning Torah is almost meaningless. It's only the Yiras Hashem and the emuna and the emotions are the context for all the Talmud, the cognitive aspect of Torah, to happen. So that's just sort of getting us ready to open us up for what we're going to talk about tonight. There's just another moment of introduction. The Shlach HaKadosh writes that Shavuos is the Yom HaDin for Ruchnias. So we have Yom HaDin, you know, before Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah for everything else, but for Ruchnias, for Talmud Torah, Shavuos is the Yom HaDin. And everybody gets judged what kind of year will look in terms of their Talmud Torah. So let's think about what we could do to merit a year full of Torah. So we'll start with the Gemara in Nedarim. The Gemara asks a very simple question. Nedarim Pei Aleph asks, that, and this is not a modern phenomenon, but it happened in the time of the Gemara, how can we see if there are Talmid HaChachamim walking around and their children don't always stay on the Derech? You have great Talmid HaChachamim, their children don't follow in their ways. And we could offer whatever sociological answers we want to offer, but the Gemara says, Al Shalo Berchu Batorah Tchila, because they didn't say Berchas HaTorah. These parents, these Talmid HaChachamim fathers, didn't say and mothers, didn't say Birchas HaTorah before they davened. So that's what the Gemara says, and we have to understand what the Gemara means. That's what we're going to work on for the next few minutes. How could it be that because a parent didn't say Birchas HaTorah, that's why their children will not follow in their footsteps? So we're going to present a few different ways to look at it. And Rashi says the simplest answer, very practical. What does it say in Birchas HaTorah? In Birchas HaTorah we say, V'nihiyah anachnu, v'tzetza'enu, v'tzetza'e kolamcha, yodei shumach, yodei sarasech, that we ask that our children should become Talmidei Chachamim and learn Torah. And if you don't daven for that, so it's not going to happen. So if the parents didn't daven for that, they didn't say Birchas HaTorah. So it stands to reason, Rashi explains, that it ain't going to happen. But we'll give another, a little bit of a deeper answer as we go. Let's look exactly at what Birchas HaTorah is all about. So there's a funny question. It's a question that we might not have asked, but somebody asked it. The Rashba was the Gadol Hador. Where did he live? Anyone know where he lived? Was he in Barcelona? Okay. And he was simultaneously, I think was it the Rush? I don't remember if it was the Rush or the Rash, but he started off in Ashkenaz, and then he was a Talmud of the Maharami Rottenberg. Who was that? That was the Rush, thank you. I told the story once, I think. Okay, so not the Rash, but... So the Rush was the Talmud of the Maharami Rottenberg. You know the story of the Maharami Rottenberg. He was taken prisoner. He was taken captive by King Rudolf, and he refused to allow himself to be redeemed because he thought it was against the Mishnah that says you're not allowed to redeem a person for more than their value, and he refused to allow himself to be redeemed. That's a different shir that I gave a few years ago. It's available online about redeeming hostages. And his Talmud, after they captured the Maharami Rottenberg, the Rush, who was next in line, realized that, hey, they got my Rebbe, who's next on the line is going to be me. So the Rush ran from Ashkenaz and escaped to, I guess, Barcelona. And along the way, he escaped to wherever he was going to escape to in Spain, and along the way he stopped for either a day or for 3 days in Barcelona to talk to the Rashba. So that was when the Rashba started in Ashkenaz and ended up in Sfar. But anyway, the Rashba in Barcelona got the following question. The question was, how come we don't make a bracha after we learn Torah? Not really sure what the question is asking. I'm saying, why should you? After all, do you make a bracha like when your candles go out on Friday night? Do I make a bracha when I take off my tefillin? Why should Birchas HaTorah require bracha after? Like, what's even the thought process that it might even require a bracha afterwards? So the Rashba writes the following. He says, you know why there's no bracha after we learn Torah? Because he brings a Mishnah in Nida, Daf Pe'alef, that lists, there's a whole bunch of things that get brachos after you do them. Mitzvahs, we don't say brachos afterwards. But, the Gemara there says, that B'nai Ma'arava, let's think for a second, let's think geography now. If you're Talmud Bavli, where's Talmud Bavli written?
Bavel,
excellent. So if you're in Bavel, and you're talking about the B'nai Ma'arava, what's to the west, Ma'arav, of Bavel? Eretz Yisrael. So whenever the Gemara Talmud Bavli wants to refer to people in Eretz Yisrael, they call them B'nai Ma'arava. Okay? So the Gemara there says, Talmud Bavli says, that B'nai Ma'arava, the people in Eretz Yisrael, would say a bracha after they would finish doing mitzvahs. When they would take off their tefillin, they made a separate bracha after they took off their tefillin, a special bracha taking off their tefillin. But we don't do that, we just make brachas before. Why is it? Why do they say a bracha when they take off their tefillin? But yet when it comes to Birchas HaTorah, no one makes a bracha. Even the B'nai Ma'arava don't make a bracha when they finish learning Torah. The Rashba answers because when you have something that has an end, then it's appropriate to make a bracha. When's the end? Tefillin was a big controversy a few months ago. What could we say about tefillin? Why would we say that tefillin has an end to the mitzvah?
Because you take them off.
How so is it time-bound? It is time-bound, that's correct. But why is it time-bound? When is it not permitted to wear tefillin? No, you could be fasting with tefillin on. Tishvav, that's a different thing because it's a pe'er and we have afer. So the first day of mourning, that's also true?
Yom Tov.
That's also true? More common than that? You do not have to put it on at a certain time. Tefillin are not allowed to be worn balayla. So, every single day that your person puts on tefillin, there's an end at the end of the day. So, okay, there is a beginning and there's an end. If there's an end, then it makes sense that one can say a bracha when there's an end, a definitive end. However, says the Rashba, and this is the beautiful point, says the Rashba, is there any end to learning Torah? That's why there's no bracha for Torah after you finish learning. Because we're asked for all the other mitzvahs. There could be an end, whatever the end is, when it stops, when the chiyuv stops, and you're not allowed to do it. When it comes to Torah, a person is always, there's always opportunity to learn more Torah, and that's why, says the Rashi, a very beautiful answer, there's no end, so therefore there's no bracha at the end of birchas, at the end of learning Torah. But there's one of the early achronim was named Levush. Levush, named his series of svarim, I don't know, about six, seven, eight svarim, all after Psukim from Megillas Esther. I'm not sure why. Maybe his name is Mordechai. I don't know. So there's Levush HaTcheles, Levush Mordechai, Levush this, Levush that, Levush everything. He has like seven different Sfarim, all named, all hinting to things in Megillas Esther. The Levush says something funny. He says that there is a birchas, a bracha that you make after you learn Torah. Who could think of a bracha that they make after they learn Torah? You are right that Shema is a unit of learning Torah, and we do make a bracha afterwards. That is true, Gal Yisrael. I'm asking in an unfair way, because it's not really that we make a bracha after we finish learning Torah. You know what he says? He says, well, in the morning I wake up, before I learn Torah, I have to say Brachas HaTorah, right? What? Hamap is a beautiful bracha, but it doesn't mention anything about Torah. So listen to what the Levush says. The Levush says that it's impossible to put a bracha at night after we finish learning, because we're supposed to, at least ideally, men are supposed to be learning until they sleep. So if you're learning or thinking of learning until a person's falling asleep, so there's no opportunity to say a bracha then. So what's the next opportunity a person has? Exactly. The Birchas HaTorah in the next morning is the end bracha of the Birchas HaTorah, of the mitzvah of Torah on the day before. That's a fascinating, funny, a little bit different answer of the Levush, and that's what he says, that there are two brachas that we say every day. The two brachas that we say, Asher Kedisham Sitzav Yisrael Atzav Kedisham Yisrael, then Varevna Shabachar Then Asher Bachar Banu, those two different brachas, they have two different purposes. One is to start off today's bracha. I said that wrong. The first bracha is a siyum of yesterday's mitzvah of Talmud Torah. The second bracha every morning is a new beginning of today's mitzvah of Talmud Torah. So it ends up that he's saying that we have a bracha achrona of Birchas HaTorah. Now, it's starting to sound a little funny. I'm talking about a bracha achrona on doing the mitzvah of Talmud Torah. You know what it's almost sounding like? Sound like a Birchas, like when we eat apples, I say bracha rishona, I have a bracha achrona. But could I, if I have an apple, even if I have an apple, my kids always want to eat food before they go to sleep, right? So we started this new policy, and I mean, we've always tried to, you can't obviously have a piece of cake after we brushed your teeth. We're not going to be a piece of cake. So, okay, so my son, his bedtime is whatever, 8:30, that's why I always come 15 minutes late to my 8:30 shiur, because his bedtime is 8:30, so till whatever happens, till I get out, it's always after that. So what happens at 8:30 when he finishes reading and the lights go out? All of a sudden he decides he's hungry. So the new mahalach is, sure, take a fruit or a vegetable. So it just takes all the fun out of eating, if you have to eat a fruit or a vegetable, but that's at least our minimal attempt to try to, involve fruits and vegetables in our children's diets. So if you have a fruit or vegetable right before you go to sleep, could you say a bracha achrona the next morning? Very priya ate, you eat your apple, and you go to sleep. Could you make a bracha achrona the next morning? Why not? 72 minutes, of course. You don't feel full from it. And it's 72 minutes after, two things. Right? If you still feel full from a meal, you could bench after 72 minutes. But if you don't feel full, and 72 minutes have passed, so there's no more, it's digested, there's nothing there. So how could the Levush say that the bracha that we say in the morning is the after bracha of the learning that we had yesterday? That's the answer. 100% right. When it comes to Torah, the Torah that you learned yesterday, it didn't just go away and digest and, it's over. The Torah that you had yesterday, it became a part of you. It became a part of us. And that's what we're going to talk about I don't know if he says that point itself, but, I think that's, I'm sorry, I don't know your name. Chava? Oh, okay, great. Nice to see you. So that's the answer that the Levush, I don't know if the Levush says that or that's somebody else says that, but that's what I think the Stifle Gaon says that. I don't remember who says that exactly. Okay, so that's a few perspectives about Birchas HaTorah. I want to talk about one more point about Birchas HaTorah and try to understand what it means when the Gemara says that because they didn't say Birchas HaTorah, the children didn't grow up to become Talmidei Chacham. And in order to understand this, we're going to have to take Birchas HaTorah a step deeper. There's another Chazal. Gemara Nedarim says that. Hold on, please. I usually don't use my computer. I just went to print out my papers, and the printer was broken, so it's a little bit more cumbersome. Okay. This is an idea that I think I might have mentioned in a drasha a few months ago, but most of you probably weren't there, so we'll try it on. I really like chocolate chip cookies. That's point A. Point B is I really don't like you. So I have the halacha grants me the ability to make a neder. Now normally when we think of a neder means I will do something or I won't do something. But halacha also gives me an ability within the context of neder to make a neder that prohibits you from eating my things. I could put a neder on my item that you're not allowed to get any hana'ah from my items. So if I have a baseball bat and I make you netherized from this baseball bat, it will be also deraisa for you to get hana'ah from that baseball bat. It's as though I'm making a neder that it's almost a restraining order. You can't come close to my chocolate chip cookies, to my baseball bat, whatever I put a neder on. That's a halacha that is called mudar hana'ah. A neder had been applied to keep your friend off limits from something. Now, let's say I make a neder that you can't get hana'ah from my rule of pasuk. Are you going to be able to shake my lulav and esrog? Well, the question is, if you shake my lulav and esrog, did you derive hana'ah? Did you get any benefit from that? You're right, so I should give a different example. Thank you. Let's talk about a shofar. You're right. Let's say I make a neder that you can't get hana'ah from my shofar. Or I make a neder, you can't get hana'ah from my sukkah. You can't get hana'ah from my tefillin, you can't get hana'ah from whatever other mitzvah item. The words that would have to be articulated would be, I am madir you hana'ah from this item of mine. I put a neder on you to not be... No. Nothing bad about you. I'm just saying this is off limits. I'm just saying this one item, this cup, I'm being madir hana, that person could say, and you will not be able to use this cup for any productive thing. She's a wonderful person. We could be best friends. This is just gonna be off limits to her. So it's nothing negative. It's just putting one thing off limits to somebody else. I could actually do it about everything I own also. I could say everything I own is mudah hana, and you're not able to get benefit from anything I own. That's a little stronger, but it works. Now, when we talk about mitzvos, is a person shaking a lulav, a person putting on tefillin, the opportunity of a person to hear shofar, are those hana'as? Are those benefits? Are those enjoyments? Are those pleasures? So, well, we could argue that could be a good philosophical discussion, but the Gemara tells us that kiyum ha-mitzvos, mitzvos were given out of obligation. We're obligated to do mitzvos. We don't do mitzvos because we love doing mitzvos. I have my wife's phone. Hi, I took your phone, I'm sorry. Bye-bye. That's what happens when your kids play video games on phones when they're not supposed to, so you take the phone away, and then you forget to give it back. Okay, so the Gemara tells us that mitzvahs are given to fulfill out of obligation, and therefore doing a mitzvah is not a hana'ah. And therefore, I'll ask you the question one more time. Could you use if I say you can't get hana'ah from my lulav, from my shofar, from my tefillin, from my whatever, could you get hana'ah? Could you use it? Could you do a mitzvah with it? Could you blow that shofar? Could you shake that lulav? Could you put on that tefillin? Yes, you can. Even though I made it off limits, I said you can't derive hana'ah from this item, doing a mitzvah with something is not called getting hana'ah. You're doing it because you have to do it, not because you love shaking lulavs and you enjoy wrapping black boxes around your arms. Yeah.
Didn't we say last time that you can't steal from rich kids before in order to a mitzvah, you can't do an aveira?
Exactly. So this is not even an aveira. Because the only thing that I put you off limits, I said you cannot derive hana'ah from this. You using it to fulfill a mitzvah, that's not called hana'ah. From a halachic perspective, it's a little bit of a subtle point. You're not, yes, you're using it. I didn't say you can't use it. I said you can't get any benefit from it. And fulfillment of mitzvahs, the Torah perceives.
Are you trying to better that you can make against your items that you can't get hana'ah from it? Or you can say you can't use it.
You can't touch it, you can't go near it. I'm not sure about the answer to your question.
Okay.
That's a great question. I'm not sure about the answer.
I mean, it's a simple question.
This is all background. The point that I want to yes come to is the next point. What happens, this is what the Shulchan Aruch says, if I say, I, with power of a neder, don't allow you to use my sefer. Are you allowed to use my sefer? For some reason, even though you are allowed to use my shofar, you are allowed to use my luv and esrog, you are allowed to use my tefillin, for some reason, the Shulchan Aruch paskins that you're not allowed to use my sefer. Where lies the difference? How come when it comes to using a lulav and using a shofar and using a tefillin, there, all those different things, I say it's off limits for me, you're not allowed to get hana from it. But you're allowed to use it because it's not a hana.
You get hana from Torah.
Ah, that's the answer. Torah is conceptually different. It's a different chefa. It's an entirely different mitzvah. It's a different existence than the rest of mitzvahs. All the mitzvahs in the world are given for what purpose? Obligation. Duty, responsibility. We have a responsibility as Jews to fulfill mitzvah A, B, C. Torah, it's true there's a mitzvah to learn Torah. It's true that men are obligated to learn Torah every morning, every night. But Torah is given to us not out of duty and obligation, but out of the point of Torah is to be have hana'ah. And that's where this concept, which sounds a little bit hashkafic, I'm showing you black and white in Hilchos Nidarim in the Shulchan Aruch, that the concept of looking at Torah not as duty or obligation, but as a hanan and as a joy and as a privilege and as something that's fun and enjoyable, actually makes its way to halacha and hilchos nedarim. And therefore, when it comes to learning Torah, if I say you can't use my sefer, well, it would be considered a hanah for you to use the sefer, and therefore you're off limits from using my sefer. All the other tools, mitzvah tools, you're going to be allowed to, because that's not using them for mitzvah is not considered a hanah. Hold on one second. What do we get from this? We get that when it comes to Talmud Torah is different a little bit than other mitzvahs. I mean, we're familiar with this mentioned Tisha B'Av earlier. Tisha B'Av, Avelim, are not allowed to learn Torah because Torah, you know, Pekudei Hashem Yisharim is Sam Chilev. Torah is something that brings about simcha. There was a little bit of a tangent, but in the beginning of the Hasidish, the advent of Hasidism, in the time of the Gra, in the time of Reb Chaim Volozhin and the Baal Shem Tov, and the early stages, there was a lot of tension in terms of how to look at the purpose of Torah. What's the goal of Torah? Is the Torah to bring you closer to Hashem, to make you feel inspired, or is Torah just to learn Torah? And that was the whole Sefer Nefesh HaChaim, a quarter of that Sefer that Reb Chaim Volozhin wrote, was sort of a diatribe against the Hasidim who were into sort of learning Torah to get you, to uplift you. And our approach, the Misnagdish approach, was we don't learn Torah to uplift ourselves, we learn Torah because we have to learn Torah. That doesn't mean, and this is something that's very important to clarify, it doesn't mean that the Hasidim believe in doing mitzvahs and having simcha, and we believe that you're not allowed to be happy. Although, Hasidim, I actually had a fellow who grew up in a Hasidish and is not Hasidish, and I was talking to him about whatever I was talking to him about, and he made a comment that really struck me. I said something like, oh, they weren't worried, like, he went somewhere where, to Yeshiva, where it wasn't Hasidish, I don't remember the exact details. And he made a dry comment to me, like, "Oh, you worried that I'm going to get drawn by your what is it?" He had a really good line. He was talking about the fact that by then everything's warm and happy and fuzzy, and by us it's all dry and, you know, Kugel's cold. And so he was saying that I don't have to be worried that he's going to come back to be misnagged because there's nothing here. So, okay, I'm happy who I am. But we're not getting into the question about that question. That's a very specific question. The nature of Torah Lishma is Torah Lishma to inspire, is the purpose of Torah to bring a person to Yerushalayim, or is the purpose of Torah just to learn Torah? That's a different issue. What we're saying here is that the point of Talmud Torah, the mitzvah of Torah is something that Hashem wants us to engage our minds, which is our highest level of the human experience, to engage in acrobatics, in mental acrobatics, and to engage our minds in HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Torah in a way that brings us simcha, that brings us tanuk. Based on that, we could come sort of full circle in this little point. Gemara says, besides the Gemara that I mentioned earlier, that a person doesn't always have children, Talmidei Chacham, if they don't say Berachas HaTorah, there's another Gemara that says that Yerushalayim was destroyed al shelo berchu b'Torah tchila. Al shelo berchu b'Torah tchila. Now, based on what we said, that there's a certain, the nature of Torah is something that is of Hana'ah. As opposed to all the mitzvahs, Torah is something that's to enjoy. Well, Birchas HaTorah now has what kind of connotation, if that's the case? Birchas HaTorah, as funny as it sounds, one could argue, and the Stipli Gaon suggests something like this, that Birchas HaTorah is not just a regular Birchas HaMitzvah. Birchas HaTorah has a component of being a Birchas HaNehemim, a Birch of Hanah. What happens if that's how we want to look at Birchas HaTorah? What happens if a person chooses to not say Birchas HaTorah? What's that demonstrating? If I tell you that when I take medicine, I drink that cup of water, I don't have to make a shahakal on that water. What does that tell you? That I don't get hana from the water that I take with medicine. It's meaningless. It's just there. So what will be if I tell you that I learn Torah, but I don't say the bracha the brachas anen on Torah. What am I trying to say? That I don't enjoy Torah. That there's nothing in it. It's not, it doesn't engage me, it doesn't involve me, I'm not into it, I don't appreciate it. Oh. That's much more than one prat in the halacha. They did say the bracha, they didn't say the bracha. That's a whole attitude towards Torah and perhaps towards mitzvot, is that, ashalo berachah b'Torah tchila. That's why Yerushalayim was destroyed, because they just had an attitude, this careless, this uncaring, this apathetical attitude towards Torah, and that's why Yerushalayim was destroyed. There's a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful Shulchan Aruch HaRav, and I want to share a fabulous story, a true story, about one of my students. The Shulchan Aruch HaRav was written, who is the Shulchan Aruch HaRav written by? It was written by the first Lubavitcher Rebbe. And besides writing the Tanya, which he's more well-known in some circles, he wrote an incredible, incredible Sefer Halacha, Shulchan Aruch HaRav, called that way because he was called the Rav. And it's funny, by the way, every circle, sociological circle that you find yourselves, the name the Rav means something else. In YU, the Rav always means Rav Soloveitchik. If you go to other places, if you go to Yerushalayim, the Rav is the Brisker Rav. If you go to America, it's Harav. America is Harav. In Eretz Yisrael, the Rav is Rav Kook. So it's really like we're very, you know, us YU people are very much in our little bubble, and we think, okay, it's just important to have wide perspectives. So Shulchan Aruch HaRav, that the first Lubavitcher Rebbe wrote, so what he does is something incredible. A lot of times the Shulchan Aruch has a psak, and the Achronim have a problem with the psak of the Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch HaRav, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe, in an absolute brilliance, sometimes rephrases things that the Shulchan Aruch writes, and the way he rephrases them, it sort of eludes and evades and answers up the question that the poskim asked on the Shulchan Aruch's psak. So he did a brilliant work. So in there he has an incredible, most of the time he follows the Shulchan Aruch relatively similarly, except in this section, Hilchas Birchas HaTorah. He goes on, he writes a masterpiece about Torah and how beautiful Torah is, and it's, if you find yourselves in a Chabad family who had a Shulchan Aruch Rav on hand, take out Shulchan Aruch Rav, Chelek Aleph, look for the piece on Birchas HaTorah, which is towards the very beginning of Chelek Aleph, sort of like the same pattern as the Mishnah Berurah, same order as Shulchan Aruch. So probably about Simon Lamed or something, or Lamed Hey. Oh, Mem Zayin, I have it here. So he says the following. He says, listen to these words. When a person says Birchas HaTorah in the morning, and this is something for you to try to do tomorrow morning, so that you could show that you didn't digest the Torah that we learned tonight. This is what he says. When a person recites Birchas HaTorah every morning, a person should be mevarich b'simcha yoser, more, me'al kol hana'os shaba olam. Person should, I've tried this, it's not easy, but you try, as you're saying the Birchas HaTorah, try to just think of, wow, I'm lucky. Wow, I'm happy. Wow, we have something special. Try it on for a size. See what happens tomorrow morning. It's a good way to start your day. You know, you get out of bed. It's so hard to, you know, get your body up and to schlep out of, you know, to take your covers off and to... Hopefully, this could be a, you know, way of like injecting a little bit of simcha in those difficult early morning hours. I want to share with you a story that I think is a great a ma'aseh shehaya. I had a student. I don't want to say his name, but he was my student. Sometime one of my earlier students when I started teaching, and he was from a Latin American country, and he was six foot tall. Broad, blonde hair, blue eyes, and he was a musician. And he told me towards the middle or end of the year, he told me the following story. He said that when I taught people who are, you know, that class, it was a class for more beginners, and he came to my share as a more beginner, and then he went to very high share in yeshiva here. And he said when I was in, I think, 11th grade, I had a rock band in my Latin American country. And our music was being, you know, did I ever tell the story? Hashemah? Okay, fine. Have you heard it, Aliza? Okay, fine. So a few people heard it, but it's worth telling again. Because it's a true story. I had a rock band, and my friends and I, we played, and we recorded, and it started, you know, making its inroads into the Spanish-speaking community, you know, the country that they lived in, somewhere in Latin America. And we were getting on the radio, you know, we had reached a point that we were on the radio a few times a week, national radio a few times a week. It's a big country. And we got an invitation. I had it written down. I don't remember if it was Sony or Universal. I think it was Universal Recording, that they wanted to see us. They want to make sure it's real. So they wanted to come to an on-live transmission, an on-the-air live transmission, and we would play, you know, on the air, a live recording. Well, that's an oxymoron. A live playing, a live something or other. And after that, we'll sign a contract with Universal Studios. Now, you think you have this completely non-religious, not only non-religious, but anti-religious. Why? Because his mother or father at that point were dabbling in Judaism. And he was very angry about that, and that played a role. I'll tell you why in a minute. So, on the air, they're on the air, right? National radio, and this is before there was TV. No, this is about 15 years ago, 13 years ago, about 15 years ago. While he was on the radio, his guitar player's string snapped, and his drummer's either. He lost his drumstick or drumstick snap broke or something like that, and it ended up being a fiasco, and they didn't get the deal. And Baruch Hashem, Rabbi Orlin, now I'm in your shir. That was the story that he told me, and those are the words that he said after he told me the story. What is he saying? He's saying exactly what the Shulchan Aruch Rav says. The Shulchan Aruch Rav says, Yivarech Birchas HaTorah, Yoser Mikol. I'm saying, what does a 16-year-old fellow who has a rock band that is about to get a contract with Universal Recording and to be able to say, Baruch Hashem, it didn't work out, I lost the contract, and Baruch Hashem, I'm in your shir. That's what the Baal HaTanya said. Yivarech B'Simcha Yoser Mikol Kol HaNos Shabbalam. I could have been a rock, so I could have been a millionaire of who knows what, and here I am, Baruch Hashem, I'm in your shir. And the story that's the point that I wanted to just show, that the kiyum, the nowadays kiyum, what does it mean to be, say, a birch satorah with an appreciation? So his mother, I told you, started dabbling, and he got angry, and he started learning Torah to prove his mother wrong. That's how he ended up in YU. And then he realized that he liked it, and he liked it more and more. So in his attempts to prove his mother wrong, the Torah that he learned thereby ended up bringing him to Torah and coming to learn in Baruch Hashem. Now, he's a genuine, genuine Ben Torah. There's a very beautiful Medrash in Shir HaShirim, in the Medrash on Shir HaShirim, that talks about the following. It's a story you might have heard, but it's not really just a story. This I also might have said on a Shabbos at some point. talks. It's a story about a. It doesn't say a king. It says a governor or a feudal lord or something, who has these serfs or these workers, poalim, and he tells them, "I want you to fill these buckets with water." And the serfs look at the buckets and they see that on the bottom of every bucket there's a big hole. So there are two of these worker bees there, and they talk to each other. One guy says, "I'm not going to waste my time doing all this work." The master, whoever it is, the Lord said that I have to do something. It's not going to get anywhere. I'm not going to waste my time. The other one said, "Hey, if he told us to do it, he's going to pay us for whatever buckets we fill. He told us to do it. If we do it, he says, we're going to get paid." So one guy walks away and is muttering under his breath, and the other guy sticks to it and does what the guy tells him to do. So the Bikeach, the one who is there, says to himself, "What's going to happen? I'm going to sit and learn Torah. Whatever I learn, I'm going to forget. I come to every early shiur every Monday night, and I don't remember a darn thing that he says. I've been in the shiur for 3 years or 4 years. I don't remember anything." Some people know. Some people do remember. But a lot of people might feel, you know, you come on Monday night or whatever it is, and you learn and you learn and you learn. You don't remember anything you learn. So it's like just filling up a bucket, just goes in the bucket and goes out the bottom of the bucket. That's all it is. In one ear and out the other ear. What does the Pekeach say? Pekeach says, Hashem says this is what we're supposed to do, so I'm going to do what I have to do, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to reward us for what he told us to do. That's the Medrash. It's a beautiful Medrash. The Chofetz Chaim adds a very important point, because the Medrash is hard to understand. If that's what Hashem wants us to do, to fill our empty buckets, what's Hashem thinking? Why should we? Okay, yes, he'll pay us nicely for doing what he wants us to do, to fill our buckets, our buckets that have big holes in them, to fill them up and let it go in one ear and out the other. Great, I'll do it because I'll get reward. But why would Hashem want that? Chofetz Chaim says something so beautiful. He says, because why do you tell somebody to pour water into a bucket that has a hole in it? Because the bucket's dirty. And when you pour water through it, and it goes out the bottom, yeah, you're not trying to save the water, you're cleaning the water, you're cleaning the bucket. Says the Chofetz Chaim, that's exactly, we have a guf, we have a neshama. It says, true, the Torah that we learn might just come in one ear, but as it goes through from one ear to that other, out the other ear, it cleans everything as it passes through. The point of the Torah, even if we forget, it still mizachech et hanefesh, it still purifies, still cleanses, still elevates the person, even if they don't remember the specific details and halachos and psukim and mishnayos and gemaras and whatever they might have learned. Without that, the experience of learning the Torah cleanses the person, even without the actual knowledge that they might not necessarily end up with. There's a beautiful Ruach HaChaim. We mentioned Ruach HaChaim V'lajin before. So Ruach HaChaim V'lajin has a sefer Ruach HaChaim on Avos. And the sixth parak of Pirkei Avos, which is really not they're really not Mishnayos, they're really Brises, it's called Parak Kinyan Torah, where it talks about all the milos of Talmud Torah. So over there, the Reb Chaim V'lajin gives a very beautiful mashal. He says that when we have king's treasury, anyone here been to England? Anyone here been to, what is it called? The London, is it the London Tower? Or is it the, where do they keep the crown jewels?
Tower of London.
Tower of London, it is the Tower of London. Okay, good. Anyone been there? Okay, so I was in London I had a flight from Israel to America and a stopover in London. So instead of it being a 3-hour stopover, I made it into an 18-hour stopover. I got in at night, went to a friend's house to sleep, and then I spent 6 hours seeing all of London in 6 hours. So I didn't go into anything, but I saw everything. It's a lot of fun. So I passed by the Tower of London, and I heard that they have inside the crown jewels that you could see if you pay a lot of money and go inside and you have a lot of time. I didn't. I don't know exactly how it is in the Tower of London, but I'm assuming that they have the Hope Diamond there. Is the Hope Diamond there? That's the biggest diamond in the world. No, I don't know. Okay, what's that? Oh, the crown itself. Do you see it? Mm-hmm. Do you saw the crown? Mm-hmm. Okay, let's assume that that's the most valuable piece of jewelry in the world. Period. Nikuda. Let's assume. So I wasn't inside. You were. You'll tell me. Okay, you pay £10 sterling as admission. Okay, you walk in. As you walk in, is that what you're going to see?
And you see everything. You're on a walkway.
Okay, so I'm going to ask you, what happens right when you walk in? I'm assuming it goes like this.
Okay.
I'm assuming you see, a nice scepter, or a nice diamond, or a nice ring. And then you go to the next room and you see something nicer. Then you go to the next room and you see something nicer. And then at some point you get all the way up to the, you know, the innermost sanctum of the Tower of London, and then there's the crown. There's the royal crown. I assume that's how it works. Well, that's what Rav Chaim Volozhin also assumed. That if you have the king's treasury, it starts off, you see the nice things, and then you open up a door, you see, oh my gosh, I didn't realize there are things could be nicer. And you open up another door. Rav Chaim Volozhin says that's exactly what Talmud Torah is. When a person learns Torah, you know, the first time they learn Torah, they taste a little bit from the outside. Oh, it looks nice. And they don't even realize what Torah could have. As a person gets more involved in Torah, they open the door to go to a deeper room. Wow, Torah has even more to offer. And then a deeper room, a deeper room, a deeper room, until the more, they don't even realize when you're on the outside, they don't realize, you know what it's like? It's like trying to explain to somebody who's not religious how much you love Shabbos. How much, like, if I didn't have Shabbos, I would just collapse. They're like, it's all these restrictions. You can't flick on a light, you can't watch TV, you can't text, you can't drive, you can't go to the ball game, and you're calling that, like, life. But again, that's it. When a person's on the outside, you can't even realize what there is on the inside. Chaim Volozhin says that's exactly what Torah is. When we're on the outside, we don't even realize that what's behind the next door. You go in a little bit, open the door, oh, there's something incredible. And it gets more and more and more. The more that we become connected to Torah, the more there is for us to experience. I want to just finish with one or two more thoughts about Torah in general, Talmud Torah. There's a funny halacha. There's a halacha, and I always tell my students, I think I might have spoken here, in the weeks before Pesach, whatever topic I'm doing, I always point out that halacha requires that 30 days before any given chag, at least Pesach, it's a question about the other chagim, if a person asks a question relating to that chag, the Rebbe is obligated by halacha to interrupt whatever he's discussing to answer that question. So if we're learning, let's say, Masechta, we're learning in Yeshiva, we're learning Masechta above a Basra, above a Metzia, we're learning Masechta Shabbos this year. And then 2 weeks before Pesach, one of my students, in the middle of my shiur, interrupts me and says, Rebbe, how do I do Mechiras Chametz, or how does Bittul Chametz work? I'm obligated by Halacha to stop and to explain it to him. Barring that situation, if it's not 30 days before the Chag, the Halacha is the following. A student is not permitted to ask something that is not being discussed right now by the Rebbe. The Halacha says the following. The Gemara says as follows. That, ki koi Rebbe, when the Rebbe is standing, koi is Aramaic for omeid. When the Rebbe is omeid, behind mesechta, in one mesechta, al tishale, you can't ask him, for mesechta achrita, in another mesechta. You know, it's usher. It's usher to ask a Rebbe, if I'm giving shir on whatever I'm giving, sure, you have no right to ask me a question on something that's not connected. Now, why is that so? The simple reason why we assume it's not fair to the Rebbe. If his mind is, you know, if I'm thinking about this, I might be embarrassed. If you'll embarrass me, if you ask me a question on something that I'm not holding and that I'm not working on, that I'm not involved in, I'll be embarrassed. And it's not fair to me to embarrass me by asking me something if my mind isn't really on it. That's how we would have learned, and that's the simple reading of this, of the Gemara. It's Gemara and Shabbos. But the Pachad Yitzchak, Rav Yitzchak Huttner, says something absolutely differently. Rav Huttner says an incredible idea, and the proof that he brings is even more incredible. Rav Huttner says, I'll read you the words. I'll paraphrase them. It's not that we aren't supposed to ask a Rebbe or a teacher about something else out of the intellectual poverty of the person who's teaching. It's the exact opposite. To the extent of the person who's teaching's greatness, it's that extent that they are so incredibly focused on what they're doing. Hishtak'ut Gmura umuchletet, a complete hishtakut, lishtake means like to submerge, a complete submersion in whatever a person's doing, that's so absolute that when you're totally submerged in something, you should not be able to respond to something that's outside of that which you're submerged and focused on. So that's why it's usher, because it's not because he might not know the answer and that's going to be embarrassing to him. is because if you're asking a question on something else, you're assuming that your Rebbe is not completely submerged and focused on what he's doing now, and that's a slap in the face. Listen to the proof that he brings to this idea. Chazal say that at Matan Torah and Maimon Har Sinai, listen to this line. Kol dibur v'dibur, shehaya yotze mipi HaKadosh Baruch Hu, every line, every word that HaKadosh Baruch Hu uttered, what happened? Nismale kol ha'olam kula b'samen. Every word that Hashem uttered at Matan Torah, every phrase that he said, the whole world became infused, injected with his incredible aroma. At Maimon Har Sinai. Very simple question. I have a very simple question on that. Every single word that he uttered, the whole world became injected with this overwhelming besamim. Well, if that happened the first time, so the first word, Anochi! Okay, the whole world fills with incredible besamim. The next word, Hashem al kach hashrat zizicham yaras besamim. And what every other word, where did the first besamim go when the next word comes out and brings its own besamim? That's the Gemara asks this question. The Gemara asks, from the beginning, Nismale, the whole world was filled with besamim. So when you say, when whatever subsequent diburim of HaKadosh Baruch Hu word, those besamim go if the world was already filled. So the Gemara says that after every dibur v'dibur that Hashem uttered, Hashem had to take a ruach and blow away all of the besamim so that the next dibur could come and once again fill the world with besamim. That's the Gemara. Sounds a little funny. Try to imagine Matan Torah in this like new way. So you hear a word and there's this like, smells great, all of a sudden it's like a big wind, whoa! Darth is getting blown away, and then another word from HaKadosh Baruch, another besamim like blown the other way, and it's just a very weird image. It's not what we... But if you think about it like this, you know what this means? It means that Torah is such an absolute experience, such an incredible revelation of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that it was so overwhelming, one word completely overwhelmed a person. The only way to take away that focus that a person had on that one dibur was by something actively taking them out. Naturally, the natural state of Torah, pure Torah from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, is not just that a person learns it, experiences it, and then it dissipates. It engages, it grabs a person so much that the only way that they could be released from it is if there's something external that sort of knocks them out, that sort of, you know, wakes them, blows away the first besamim, and only then could a person submerge themselves in that second dibur of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And that's the proof, I think this beautiful proof that Rav Huttner brings, this idea that the Rebbe, when he's teaching, if a person is properly a proper Rebbe, I'm not talking like somebody like me, but somebody who's a Talmid Chacham, who's teaching at a level that they're so submerged in the Torah that they learn, they're not able to just, you know, answer this question, that question, because of their absolute submersion and focus on what they're doing. It's like the beautiful aroma of HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Diburim that are there until they are actively removed. I'll finish off with one other thought. About Maimon Har Sinai. So the pasuk says, and every rav likes to darshan about this, that kol ha'am ro'im es ha'kolos. You can't see voices and you can't hear visions. You can see visions and hear voices. How come at Matan Torah? So Rav Chaim Volozhin, not in Ruach HaChaim on Pirkei Avos, but in his Sefer Nefesh HaChaim, has a beautiful explanation, one of his footnotes in Perek Gimel, to explain what does it mean that V'chol Ha'amru Im Es HaKolos, how could they see that which is heard? He says something very, very, very beautiful. I'll finish with this. Let's talk about this chair. You see this chair? You see this chair? Is it real? It's real. You could see it. You could see it. If you touch it like I am touching it, you could feel it. It's a real chair. Okay. After we talk about the chair, I want to talk about liberty. Liberty is a great thing. Liberty is a sense of freedom. Liberty is... Do you hear what liberty is? You feel liberty? You see liberty? No. Because your sense of vision makes something real. And when you hear about something, that doesn't make it real to you. When we look at the world around us, says Reb Chaim Volozhin, what's real in our eyes? The chair is real, the table is real, my cell phone is real, the cup, the water that I'm drinking is real, my jacket is real. What's less so? Torah, mitzvos, HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It's something that we can't point to, we can't grab, we can't feel, we can't see. We have to do what? Speak about it, learn about it, try to understand it, grasp it with our minds based on what we are told. But I can't actually experience it with my senses. That's normal life. So normal life is I see what I see, and I hear what I hear. At Matan Torah is the exact opposite. All those things that are normally kolos, that normally just have to be understood through description of all the things of Ruchnias, they were visible. They were seen in total reality. And the universe was true also. And when they, what does it mean that they heard the things that person normally sees? All of Olam Hazeh, the things that are physical that you see, they realize that at this incredible Maamar HaSinai, when they saw the truth of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, they realized that all of the things of Olam Hazeh, they had to be, it's as though you had to explain to somebody what a chair is, and, you know, that chair is not really there, it's, you sort of have to explain it to you, there's black over here and gray over here, and it's a shape like this, and it feels like this, and hard on the outside and soft over here by the padding. They weren't able to understand it because of their incredible perception of what truth really was at Maamar HaSinai. And I had a different kind of Talmud, not like the other one. But that's a funny shayla. Sad shayla, but a funny shayla. He was experimenting with different drugs. I think I might have told this story also at one point. And he came upon psychedelic mushrooms. And apparently, for all those who aren't so familiar, he said that they make you feel very spiritual and very, I'm scared to use the word religious, but yeah. Make you feel very ruchnius dick in whatever his perception of what ruchnius was. And he wanted to know, Rabbi, you know, this is a good, right? He's a guy who has a hard enough time with Judaism here. He found something to help him, right? Is it a good idea? So I think he's just trying to elicit a reaction from me. I said, let me think about it. And you have to think about it. I think this is what the psychedelic mushrooms do. They make a person realize that the things that are all physical, they're all just, I don't know, it becomes fake, and the ideas are able to grab the person. And it does exactly what Maamar HaSinai did. I'm not saying you should do psychedelic mushrooms. I told them that I think that they're not. I said, a person gets schar for what? You get schar only for one thing, for bechira. You don't get schar for the mitzvahs that you do. You get schar for the bechira that you do in the fulfillment of the mitzvahs. And if you're using a chemical-induced, if you have a chemically-induced mitzvah, so you're not getting, there's no bechir, or there's less bechir, so you're not going to schar for it anyway, so you don't get anything. That's what I told them. Well, I think I'm right. I think there's truth to what I told them. Yeah, question. Drinking up there, the mitzvah is not to achieve a state so that I could serve Hashem in a state of drunkenness. The mitzvah is to drink.
But how can you achieve a mitzvah if it's during a state of
No, so that the poskim will speak about the shir, the mitzvah is to get to a certain state. The mitzvah is not to, when you're in a state, serve Hashem. It's a different kind of setup in the way. So anyway, Hashem should give us the, obviously we're not living in this Maamar HaSinai, and when we look at a chair, we see it's very real to us. When we think of Torah mitzvahs, it's a little bit more ethereal, but hopefully through the Yom HaDin of Shavuos, Habaleinu Tova, and the learning that we do, and the commitment to learning that we do, and the connection, like the Rebbe Bechai says, especially the connection of women to the emuna and to the regesh of what Torah has to offer, and all the very simple, the kedushas hayom of Yom Matan Torah will hopefully have an impact on us and enable us to be mekabel Torah for ourselves this year, and we should always be able to realize what is real and what is less real, and always be able to make right decisions and have clarity. It was like Bnei Yisrael had that clarity. When they were in that Maamar HaSinai, we should have our clarity in our lives. And we should all be zochah to a wonderful yontif. And thank you all for coming out on this very last minute notice. And next week, I think, should be regular next week. No holiday that I forgot about. Okay. Happy Monday after Shavuos. Okay, Baruch Hashem, next week we'll continue. So with the halacha topic.